When we talk about barriers to understanding homicide, I'm primarily thinking about the public. We started our site in D.C., where there simply was not a lot of reliable information on homicides, and we started looking at our own neighborhood. So one of the first and most obvious reasons why it's hard for the public to understand homicides in general is that we simply don't have useful data. In some cities, police will put out feeds like this. This is from D.C., from the Office of the Chief Technology Officer. But and some of the cities we work with are leaders in this field, D.C., Boston, and Chicago in particular. Trenton, on the other hand, actually told us that some of this data was not public record, which is a strange thing. But this data and the movement for it tends to come from City Hall, not from police departments themselves. There's not a culture of openness in a lot of police departments. And when this data is published, it tends to be incomplete, it's sometimes inaccurate, and nearly always slower than gathering it ourselves from our reporting. If you think about a reporter writing a crime story, the first thing they write is going to have a time, a place. It may have a victim's name, sometimes it'll have a suspect's name. But that information tends to be lost. It's simply thrown away, or it's used to write a story that is not revisited. And police only present part of the picture. Remember that courts are not just separate bureaucracies, but a separate branch of government altogether. While police and prosecutors work in tandem, the judges, public defenders, victims' advocates, and all of the other actors involved are working at their have their own views of the system. It'd be simplistic to say that these groups don't talk to each other. The truth is they often have different interests, often competing interests. There's no part of the system that speaks for everyone or sees the entire picture. And this has consequences. Here's what a former prosecutor once told us. This is part of his quote, but the whole thing is, unfortunately, most people don't have any real understanding of the general workings of the criminal justice system, much less have the ability to keep up with any individual case. And that goes for the victim's family, the defendant's family, and the public at large. Strangely, the victim's families, and the defendant's families, and the general public as potential victims or defendants themselves often simultaneously feel the system is stacked against them. How can Homicide Watch help? I'm going to talk a little bit about journalism. I usually speak at journalism conferences, so forgive my going into my own field a bit. So this is Homicide Watch DC, and this is today. We cover homicides in real time. We cover every case from crime to conviction. We started the site because we saw things like this. Teddy bears, the police tape, the bottles on the side of the road. A friend of ours runs a site called Washington's Other Monuments. And he drives around the city and he photographs these and he keeps a record of how victims of violent crime in D.C. are memorialized. When we started looking around, we found not only this, but also Facebook memorial pages. Comment threads on legacy.com obits. We saw t-shirts, we saw nail art, we saw all of this conversation, all this effort to understand, all of this effort that went into making sure that this continued to be talked about. And this is how homicide tends to be covered in most media. This is from a few years ago, and I looked up a victim who we've written about 10 times, a man named Henry Kelly, who was 20 years old when he died, and his mother is very active in trying to find his killer. His case is still unsolved. It turns out he was one of three people killed that night, which is what police call just a bad night. This is the only story that the Post ever wrote about him. Sorry. This is his mother. Down the bottom. Another woman who was killed that night. Selena Knight. That's not her. This is from our site. And then this is the end of her case. So her case was actually solved. But this is more than a year later, almost 2 years later. This is how a lot of media sees coverage of homicide. As a map. And this is actually from our site. This is probably the least interesting part of our site. But we do keep a map of every homicide. But what we've tried to do is go farther and focus on people. We built our site as both a database and a news feed because we wanted to make sure that people don't disappear. We wanted to give people information when they looked for it, and we wanted to make sure that we could make a promise that that information wouldn't go away. Every victim on our site has a profile page, as well as every suspect, and we track those cases all the way to the end. We track how those cases end, so if they end in a plea deal, or a jury conviction, an acquittal, or charges dropped, we know that too. We do this in four cities: D.C., Trenton, Chicago, and Boston. And we're looking for partners in other cities. I should say, actually, that our D.C. site is probably shutting down at the end of the year, just because we have moved to Boston and we can't keep running the D.C. site. Our other cities have media partnerships, but we are looking for a new partner in D.C. So what have we learned? We've learned that this is a big problem. Simply getting to the point of understanding violent crime is a large task. This is a chart that Gallup did in 2011. It's a little hard to read here, but they asked people, do you believe that crime is increasing or decreasing? And most people said, it's increasing. It's worse this year than it was last year. And the truth of it, as all of you know, is that crime has been decreasing fairly consistently since the mid-90s. So that's part of the problem that we're fighting. One of the things that we learned when we started the site was that in D.C., when people talked about violent crime, they talked about the 90s. They talked about Southeast, Anacostia. They talked about drug deals gone bad. And we found that there was no consistent source of information. And we found that we didn't trust policymakers' ability to make rational policy because they simply did not have a good source of information. They could not see who was being most affected by homicide, why they were happening, and what happened, what the outcomes of those cases were. I'll take you through a little bit. Every year we do a year in review package. We look back because we gather all of our information in a database. We can ask things like, how did victims die? So this is 2013. Overwhelmingly, guns are the cause of death. It is a problem disproportionately for young people, for people in their 20s, and less so in their 30s. I don't think I put this chart in, but it is also overwhelmingly male. And it is incredibly concentrated within the black community. Violent crime, and homicide especially, disproportionately affects marginalized communities. It is not the people in power who are having to deal with this. The question people ask, and the question we see the community asking more than anything, is how do we stop this? And what happens next? Our goal for the site is to help people understand the criminal justice system, because what people most want to know is justice done? Does the system work? Thank you.
Okay, so I'm going to leave this up so hopefully it'll continue recording. And I'm going to take questions from the audience. Basically, state your name and affiliation if you don't mind, and either address it to an individual panelist or to the group, and we can sort of volunteer up here. And panelists, if you don't mind repeating the question when you're answering it. So, a couple of hands up, and I'll, so please go ahead.
Was can ShotSpotter be used to help law enforcement prevent firearm crimes? And I think the answer is yes, but they have to be willing to integrate that data into their systems, into their practices, and we as researchers have to be willing to give them a way to do that efficiently, because it's not enough to kind of record gunshots and move in after the fact. That provides cold comfort for anyone. A lot of what needs to be done is to guide both law enforcement and service providers, groups like Cure Violence, groups like the National Network of Safe Communities. We have to, as researchers and as law enforcement, take responsibility for devising tools that can guide people to gun violence and that can maximize the use of systems like gunfire detection. Because it can be a powerful tool, but only if the systems are in place to use it effectively.
Thank you. For Ms. Parker, your data as it relates to Chicago, as I stated, seems somewhat unrealistically. When you speak about the homicide rate and fatality falling, what's the source of your information? Like, where do you get, because there have been a lot of articles out about how if the crime is not determined to be a homicide, or if they can't determine that it was definitely a homicide, even though someone may have been shot, then it goes under some other category. So it's switched from homicide to another category, and the police chief, the former police chief, or the current police chief now, his numbers, he always saying, well, although, you know, we had a recent rash of violence, the numbers, the rates, the percentages have gone down. So where is your source of information?
So the question is, what is the source of the Chicago homicide numbers presented? And so our data is CPD data. It is what they report. And I think for the most part, the open data portal that offers a lot of transparency, I think, around some of that does match up to what we get directly from CPD.
And for Mr. Amico, Chris, I appreciate you.
Thank you.
Is your partner in Chicago?
Sometimes.
And their Homicide Watch?
Yeah, so they run Homicide Watch Chicago, and it's their reporters, and then also they pull in students from the local universities.
I have a question.
So the question was about how our partnerships work, the cost and the partners. So we partner mostly to talk to news organizations. In Chicago, our partnership is with the Sun-Times. They came to us at the end of 2012, which was a really bad year in Chicago. And they said, we need a better way to cover this. They had been trying to, they had built a map of shootings and homicides. And they said, we need a better way to do this. Part of our approach is that we mix traditional beat reporting with database journalism so that we don't lose any information. We, like I said, we follow a case from crime through conviction sentencing as far as it goes. So they approached us. In our partnership in Trenton is with the Trentonian newspaper. And then in Boston, it's actually with Northeastern University, and they run it as part of their journalism program. So they, I'll actually be teaching this class in the spring. But they have students who are journalism students do the reporting using our software and using our methods. And it's just part of their training. We've been looking for other partners in other cities like this. So we're definitely interested in news organizations, but that's mostly because we're journalists ourselves and that's what we know how to work with. We've talked sort of informally with cities themselves to do this, but we don't quite know how to make that happen. And that's simply a matter of our expertise being, you know, we're reporters, we know how to talk to reporters. But if you're interested and if you know somebody in another city who might be interested in partnering with us, we'd love to talk. Each city has its own. Costs, let's talk afterwards. Each city has its own. In each case, the partner actually does the day-to-day reporting. We train the reporters. We provide the software. It's on our servers. I make sure the servers keep running. I wrote the software, so. We're a very small company. Thank you. I'm happy to talk afterwards about specifics.
We collect a lot of data about the perpetrators in the process because most of the increased risk for homicide and domestic violence cases is related to characteristics of the perpetrator. When you talk to a proxy, I mean, unfortunately, if it's like the victim's mother, if the victim is a woman, and the what she would know about the perpetrator's like mental health history, those kinds of things, is limited. We have also, and one of the things that reminds me in terms of the homicide watch is the fatality reviews that are being done of domestic violence fatalities in many states and many cities. And I was trying to think, you know, there should be some way to connect those dots. The fatality reviews are domestic violence fatalities. But definitely perpetrator characteristics need to be part of those databases, those fatality reviews. As one of the things we're urging these fatality reviews, domestic violence fatality reviews to look at is to do interviews of perpetrators, if they're willing, because there is information there in terms of their background, et cetera, as well as interviews of family members of the victim. And I oftentimes think that there could be fatality reviews that were done, for instance, of adolescent homicides. The reason that the domestic violence homicides have received this fatality review kind of attention is in part because when a woman is killed, she's far more likely to be killed by a partner than anybody else. While when men are killed, the dynamics are different. And you see many homicide studies that are done that they don't separate out the genders other than to say, you know, so many women were killed versus so many men. And then they go on to make analysis about what needs to be done for prevention, et cetera, and so forth. And it's mainly based on those homicides of males because there's more of them. And, you know, there are different kinds of strategies that you need to do to prevent the homicides of males than homicides of females. So, you know, gender does matter there, although sometimes when you read homicide literature, it's as if it doesn't. But I do think there's some lessons we've learned from other homicide studies that we could apply to domestic violence homicide studies and vice versa. And the collaborations with journalism, I think, is a fabulous way to go. And I was thinking that many of the proxies, the family members that I interviewed on the domestic violence homicides, would love it if there had been a database like Homicide Watch where they could have actually followed what happened to the case. And I also think in terms of how many of the homicides, whether it's of men or women, where the perpetrator is never known, you know, it's and sometimes where the victim is never known. And yet, you know that that victim's known to somebody way back when, and they're never identified. And the other thing is in terms of the data on the gunshots, we don't have good databases on people who have been shot but didn't die. You know, those databases are not very good. They're not very good about, you know, who's the perpetrator, what are the circumstances, et cetera, because so often in the criminal justice system, there's plea deals that are made. So you have very little information, and those are oftentimes near lethal events, and we need to be doing as much about prevention of those as we do on some of the actual homicides.
We had one in the back, and then one in the back over here.
New York City currently is controversy about what's called, depending on what side of the political spectrum you are, stop and frisk or stop question and frisk. In the spirit of bipartisanship, I'll call it stops. But there is, and they're looking to dismantle it, and two reasons that are given are, number one, only about 5% of the 700,000 stops done a year in New York City yield a weapon. And number two, that it appears to be the persons of color that are much more highly involved in the stops. Okay? Now, the dilemma, however, is that if 5% of the stops result in removals of a weapon, we're talking about 100 weapons a day being taken off the streets of New York City. And so how do you circle that square in terms of wanting to get weapons off the street at the same time dismantling a program
I'm going to sort of re-pass that question a little bit because I think it's a very interesting question, obviously, in the role of law enforcement, who are in some ways first responders to a lot of gun violence, but also about identifying risk. And I think that maybe Susan would be a good person to think about answering this, because the multi-method study and multi-city study is in many ways trying to look at categories of people, of guns, of gangs, and to look within them and to identify that, you know, not all individuals are at the same level of risk, not all guns that are used in crimes have been obtained in the same way, not all individuals in a social network are equal, and not all stops, like you're saying, are equal, but how do we respond as a community to something that's much more complicated than gun violence, that doesn't fall under the same umbrella, kind of reflecting on what Jackie just said too about how gun violence, as experienced by different genders, is vastly different, even though that the sort of mechanism of a bullet injuring a human being is the same. So why is it important to look within groups and within these categories and to identify areas of risk? And if you want to answer any way you can, it'd be great.
So I think in terms of risk categories, that's really important to look at in terms of what enforcement environment we're operating in. I think when you compare the 90s to now, that's a totally different enforcement environment given the different homicide rates. And so I think it is really important to properly calibrate what we're doing on the street versus what the realities of the community at this point and certain points in time are. That said, what we are trying to learn from the project is what patterns of risk behavior really do result in problematic or potentially dangerous behavior. And I think that's something that we don't always know. You know, a lot of people, we've done some surveys with individuals who are currently in Cook County Jail who were arrested for carrying a gun. You know, and across the board, there's a very real sense of danger on the streets and the neighborhoods from which they were arrested. And so I don't think know how to balance and properly calibrate that risk, and certainly have to take a really holistic view when we're thinking about risk, because risk is different for police, it's different for communities, it's different for all these people. But I mean, essentially, in solving this, I think we are very much in it together, and it can't just be a law enforcement answer versus a mental health answer versus like a prosecutor's answer.
So, yes, what I'd add on to Susan's comments are that while getting 5% of stops is a good thing, we can be smarter about how we do it. And I think one of the big challenges that we found with Stop and Frisk, which I'm actually just released a report on, is that when you paint with a broad geographic brush, when there's gun violence in a neighborhood and you decide you're going to go into the entire neighborhood, one, that actually reduces the efficacy of your stop and frisk operations because you've got only so many officers across a huge area. And I think what we can say is that stop and frisk isn't the enemy, but imprecise targeting most certainly is the enemy. And so one of the things that we can do is that we can improve the efficacy using gunfire detection, using community feedback, if we target it so that when we go into an area to do targeted searches, we're not saying there was gun violence in Brooklyn, so we're going to do stop and frisk in Brooklyn. If you move that into a few blocks, and this is something that's actually been done in Milwaukee, where you target your police very precisely at the block level, at the street level, then in many ways you actually get the best of both worlds. You're using gunfire detection to go to incidents, and if somebody asks, well, why am I being searched? The answer isn't because you were in this vast zip codes on zip codes neighborhood. They also can tell you, well, we had a shooting reported here 5 seconds ago. You can see there's officers there. We just want to know what happened on this street. And so I think that we need to move away from stop and frisk yes, stop and frisk no, and move into how can we use targeted searches in a way that are most effective and that keep the community as an active partner in gun violence prevention.
Like I said, we didn't have great information about their mental health, you know, true any kind of diagnostic criteria. And there was a lot of post hoc, the family member, you know, the mother, the sister, the woman who had been killed, thinking he must have been crazy. So they would say his mental health was poor, and then we'd try and find out, you know, what made them think that. Very few actual diagnoses. A lot of these perpetrators, though, had threatened to kill themselves. So there was a great deal of suicidality on their part beforehand. Now, whether or not that was depression, we were able to get some medical records of some of these perpetrators. The most common scenario there was a woman would leave her husband, boyfriend, most likely actually husband, because of the domestic violence. There was prior domestic violence in 72% of those homicide suicides. And then the perpetrator would be very distraught, very distressed is how they would be described. Oftentimes they did seek help from a mental health from a counselor or from their own primary care provider. Many of them had been prescribed antidepressants, which unfortunately is how we tend to deal with depression now, is we don't find out much more than just, you know, hand out antidepressants. So they were medicated. Whether or not they were really diagnosed as depressed, whether or not it was a situational depression, et cetera, and so forth, very little information on that. However, one of the things that I think is incredibly important here around these mental health encounters is that we think about this particular category of person, and one of the things that's so important is, you know, whether or not that person who is complaining of suicidality, you know, overtly coming to a provider and saying, I feel like I'm going to end my life, and many providers not feeling empowered to say, and do you have a gun at home? You know, that it would be so important, because the suicides, we really have many more suicides in this country than we do homicides, and that really cuts across, and almost all of them are perpetrated with guns. One of the things, for instance, we keep a very good database of suicides by our veterans, way too high, etc. Most of those are done with guns. Most of those, you know, people know they have guns. You know, that connection is something we really don't deal with it nearly enough. And what we don't know in that whole bank of data on suicides amongst our returning veterans is we don't know how many of them actually killed a partner before they killed themselves. The VA doesn't keep that information. You know, and you're like, really? Why not? You know, and that's one of the things that, you know, again, our homicides are kept in databases that come out of the police homicide reports. They are kept in the Department of Justice, through the FBI, etc. Our suicides are over here under Departments of Health, through medical examiner data, And they, you know, except through the MBDRS, they are not linked. So that's one of the other things in terms of keeping a better handle on some of the data is getting more states into the MBDRS, you know, expending the resources to do so, so that we can have better evidence-based policy around these issues. That's one way to do it. There's no getting the family members involved with perhaps.
Yeah, we ask them.
Yeah.
For treatment, is all the weapons locked up in here? Yes, but they're
not. Just a question about the Homicide Watch program. I know you mentioned that you closed down the website in DC, in Louis Box. What happened with that data? And as you expand to other cities,
thanks, that's a good question. So the question was about what happens at the end of the year if our DC site is shut down and what happens with other cities. So the DC site we ran by ourselves just as a startup news organization for 4 years. We moved to Boston 2 years ago and we changed the way we did it. So when we started, it was my wife and I ran it, and my wife was the reporter on it full-time by herself, and then we built software around that, just around her reporting process. When we moved to Boston, we changed how we approached it in D.C., and we started hiring recent college graduates as reporters, and we turned it into sort of a training program. We found that it was a really effective way to teach young journalists both beat reporting and data journalism, and to give them a better understanding of the criminal justice system. So that is our model. In a lot of ways, that's very similar to how we run with the other sites. There's a partner, and it's not us doing the reporting. So with those, it's the Sun-Times, it's the Trentonian, it's Northeastern. Doing the reporting, filling out this database, that data will stay on the internet as long as I keep paying the server bill. So the DC site, even if we stop doing the reporting, the site won't go away. Our intention is to keep it online effectively forever. And actually, we'll keep moderating comments and we'll keep... I am going to check at least once a month just for what cases have ended, because we see it as a very important part of our role to make sure that if people are acquitted or charges are dropped, that their names are cleared. And so we'll keep updating that at least until we have gone through all the suspects currently in our database. But it won't go away. We know that it's an important piece of the community, and we want to make sure that to the degree that it can still be useful to people, it is.
Opportunity to ask the last question, then, which is a little bit pie in the sky, but I've been sitting here thinking, especially in our business, we usually are told not all gun violence can be prevented, but if we could just stop one killing, it's sort of worth it. But I actually want to take a step back from that and ask the panelists, can you imagine a United States where there is no gun violence? We talked about how a lot of these institutions work or don't work on the criminal justice system, communities where people are too afraid to go outside without arming themselves, social networks that put firearms in the hands of people that shouldn't have them, people who have been identified as having a history of domestic abuse but are able to obtain firearms, children that are exposed to firearm violence, law enforcement has come up. Would anybody step up here and volunteer some ideas just sort of what a United States without gun violence would look like?
Um,
The only thing I can say is I think that ordinary citizens have to talk to their political leaders about, you know, what, without impinging on Second Amendment rights, what kinds of things make sense in this country. Because, you know, I think the political discourse has gotten just so polarized and so knee-jerk that you're either for gun regulation or against it. In many states now, physicians are not even allowed to ask about guns in the home for safety measures, and that's one of the state legislator kinds of things. So we have to be in touch with our state legislatures, because that's where a lot of the legislation is happening. And the more we can get that out, and I think, you know, through the media and through more of social media is maybe a way to do it.
To go back to what Ted talked about, I think in terms of pie in the sky, if you had told someone 20 years ago that D.C. would have less than 100 homicides a year, they would probably have told you that was pie in the sky thinking as well. And now they've not only done it, but they're sustaining those drops. So I think that I think that what needs to be done is there needs to be a lot more talk about good ways to assess gun violence. There needs to be a lot more talk about good deployment, and to talk about getting communities involved actively through programs like National Safe Communities, like Stop Violence. I think it's clear that sustainable drops in gun violence can be both created and maintained, but having the willpower and the resources to put those networks into place and sustain them, not just as a pilot program, not just as an interesting idea, but as a sustained part of policing response, is incredibly important. And again, that's going to be at least partially a political response.
I think when you look at the polls that came out of the last couple elections, people can imagine this. 70% of people, I think, supported common sense background checks. I think not only can people imagine what this looks like, but they want it to happen and have voiced that. I think I would echo Dr. Campbell with what people think and what people want isn't getting translated into some of our local and state officials. But I think that, you know, a lot of times the inevitability question comes up, but I think people do envision this and they want common sense regulation around it.
So we work at the individual level. We don't really think about, we don't really talk much about policy. But a lot of how we think about our coverage and our goals, it's about changing perception, about changing understanding. It's a story we tell a lot about a couple years ago. My wife was at D.C. Superior Court, and a detective pulls her aside and says, hey, you know, I got to tell you, we had a kid in for a, we pulled a kid in on a homicide last night. And he says, I can't tell you which case, but we sit him down, and he realizes at some point he's in for a homicide. And unprompted, he says, nah, man, I ain't killed nobody. I've seen Homicide Watch. They're locking people up for that shit now. And that, you know, they were always locking people up for that shit. But nobody saw it. And what I like to think is that we can change a person's reality. We can change a person's perception. We can change their understanding of the system. And, you know, maybe we can save somebody.
I just wanted to say, as far as your, that's some, a sense of utopia to me, to think that it would never, like we would be free of all of the gun violence or violence in itself, because the country was built on violence. And if we could eliminate things like the greed that perpetuates the mass incarceration that we see across the country,
if we could eliminate racism in classes and some of those other isms that affect the things that perpetuate the guns that come into the country that are sold illegally and end up in neighborhoods where you can't even get a decent piece of fruit in a grocery store, maybe then. But until then,
glasses half empty, glasses half full.
Thank you so much, everybody, for...